for joining us on Let's Talk About Health in Africa on the HSS podcast with me, Lenias Wenda. We are continuing our neglected tropical disease series, and today we're talking about the biggest public health crisis that you have never heard of, snake bites, also called snake envenomation and rabies virus infection. Today, my guest is Dr. Anderson Chimsoro, a public health physician who is a WHO national advisor to the Ministry of Health in Zimbabwe on neglected tropical diseases and on malaria. Dr. Chimsoro, welcome to Let's Talk About Health in Africa on the HSS podcast.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you for this discussion. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on now. Can you just start by telling us what is snake bite envenomation and how big a problem is it in Zimbabwe and in Africa in general?
Let me just start by defining envenoming itself, which is the injection of venom by an organism into another organism. And when we talk about envenomation by a snake or envenoming by a snake, this is actually the injection of venom, snake, into another object. And in this case, we are talking about injecting that poison or venom into human beings. This results in some adverse consequences, which involve swelling, which involve bleeding, which involve paralysis of some muscles, and the many other unwanted effects, including death. And this is what we actually call envenomation.
So it's really like being injected with poison, basically, which poisons you. And in some cases, if you're not treated, if you don't have an antidote, you might die. Now, how does the challenge of snake bites compare with rabies, which is another big problem in Zimbabwe and in other African countries?
Well, rabies is similarly a huge problem in Zimbabwe, in Africa, and globally. The issue is that rabies is a viral condition which is passed on by bites by an infected dog to bitten humans and so on. So this results, of course, in a condition called rabies, if not appropriately managed. And this is really a fatal condition. So a majority of people who get infected with rabies will eventually die if nothing is done about them. So this is the problem with rabies. Envenoming now, as I have said, envenoming is by snakes, is actually the injection of poison, which also may result in a great number of people who have been affected dying if nothing is done about them. And the one thing that we can say about snake bites, we know that, of course, both rabies and snake bites, they can be prevented and they can be treated as well. For snake bites, we have the immunoglobulins, which we can give those who are affected, or the anti-venoms, if I would call it immunoglobulins. How big is this problem? Okay, if you would look at the global picture for snake bite, we are talking about each year about 2.7 million cases of envenoming, which are being reported. And these, of course, the results in disabilities, they result in deaths in some of them. If we talk about and this will actually, if I will talk about the deaths which results from envenomings, These are about 80,000 to about 130,000 each year, which are reported resulting from environment. Talking about rabies. Rabies is equally an important problem. It's a global problem, which is affecting a large majority of people. And if you talk about the two conditions, for example, in Zimbabwe, relating to envenoming, we actually report about 3,000 cases of envenoming and 15 deaths in 2021. And if we talk about rabies, we actually reported about 9 cases, and most of these, of course, result in death, except if we have lost them.
Right, so indeed quite a big burden, a big challenge, more than 2 million people envenomed every year. So what are the risk factors for rabies infection and for snake envenoming as well? How do you control for this? How do you minimize those risk factors to keep communities safer?
These are neglected diseases, or as they are put, neglected tropical diseases. And they affect mostly the poor, rural communities, which have a poor access to health services. And in the case of rabies, of course, the availability of dogs, uncontrolled numbers of dogs roaming around, is actually a big risk factor. And those people who are actually, whose occupation involves working with animals and so on, are also at greater risk of rabies. If countries don't have programs for vaccination of dogs, that can also present as a big problem and the result people being in danger of rabies. For snake bites, again, this affects the majority, which are mostly the farming communities, those who are doing outdoor work. And of course, with unprotected footwear and so on. So they really get exposed to snake bites. But one thing that I would quickly say is that not all snake bites result in venom mention, or not all snakes have poisonous toxins or poisons. So many of them we have, but some of them, they just bite, or not a bite that results in envenomation.
So if you are bitten, let's say you live in an area where there are a lot of snakes, what sort of things should you do to avoid or to minimize your risk of getting bitten, for instance?
You live in an area that is potentially infested with snakes, and which is most of our areas. One of the things, of course, you should be aware that there are snakes. Just being aware, and then managing your movement. Most of the snakes bite after intimidation or after relatively being put in a position of defense. So this is when they bite. So let's have situations where we move in well-lit areas, in the areas where we can see remotely and be able to avoid confrontation with snakes, so that they take us as people who are likely to cause harm to them. So in most cases, we move side by side with snakes and nothing happens. But it's only when a snake senses danger, that is when it bites, most of them. Of course, there are some snakes which are they will just bite without any intimidation. But many of them, they bite after they sense risk. So let's just move in well-lit areas, in areas that are without a lot of grass, not a lot of bushes. If we have to move in those areas, let's be careful how we navigate our ways, and so that at least we don't look like we are posing danger to these reptiles.
So for rabies, it's really primarily the vaccination of animals, of dogs, to prevent the infection with the rabies virus when there's an animal bite. But for snakes, it's more about controlling the environment, avoiding long grasses and bushes, and making sure that you have adequate footwear to prevent being bitten, and to make sure that you're moving around in well-lit areas, presumably avoiding going out in the dark. Because these problems are obviously affecting poor rural communities where you don't have street lighting. So obviously the way to be, in well-lit areas at night, you have to basically maybe just avoid going out in the dark. Now, what is the biggest factor that contributes to the fatality? You know, when people have been envenomed by a poisonous snake, what causes so many of these people to die, even though this is something that is preventable?
Well, a poison taken is dependent upon the dose. So the amount of venom injected into us is actually going to determine whether we are going to live or we may die if nothing is done. So most of the snakes bite usually when they are trying to escape. And sometimes they don't inject that enough poison. It leaves us with that opportunity to live even after a poisonous bite. But some of them have inadequate time to prepare, and they actually strike appropriately, and they inject adequate poison. This is actually that is going to cause problems or untoward effects to human beings. But we also talk about the age and size. So you will see that for snake bites, children, because of their smaller size or volume, the same amount of poison injected into them compared to adults, children will suffer more consequences than adults, or will die, or will have adverse effects more easily than adults because of their smaller size.
Yes, so it's the dosage, I guess, compared to the size of the person that's going to determine. You mentioned then access to immunoglobulins and antidotes and preventive measures that could help to prevent an envenoming case or a bite from a rabid dog causing death in a patient. Let's talk about then access to prevention and access to treatment. Now, deaths from snake bites and rabies mainly occur in communities that have difficulty accessing, firstly, healthcare, and secondly, accessing medical products like anti-venom, rabies vaccines, and rabies immunoglobulins. Now, both conditions require treatment with these products, which are really biologics, anti-venom for snakes and rabies immunoglobulins and vaccines. These cost quite a lot of money, and they require refrigeration, and the demand for these products is usually not very certain, because you don't really, one is not collecting, at least in most countries, they are not collecting data systematically that we know for certain that this is the burden of snake bites that we have, and this is the burden of rabies. It's really what's reported presumably, that we are going on. So the demand is not really well known. So how does a health system plan for this kind of situation to make sure that you have enough of these biologics that cost a lot and that require a very complex cold supply chain in order to maintain them and make them available to people in the most remote of places in our communities?
First of all, the health system has to be aware of the burden and its distribution in the country of those conditions that we are talking about. If we talk of rabies, there are certain areas that are more prone to rabies. If we talk of snake bites, there are also certain areas that are more prone to snake bites, or which are reporting more snake bites. But generally, a kind of an assessment, it will generally be a very good idea to have that detail rather than depending on routine passive reporting from the National Health Information System. So an assessment will give adequate data to have that. Talking about snake bites, we really also want to know what kind of snakes that we are dealing with or which are prevalent in those areas. And that kind of information will also help us to contribute to the knowledge, global knowledge in the availability of dangerous snakes in our areas. And this actually will also assist the snakes that we have, and also the amount of or the data in terms of the snake bites numbers that we are reporting will also give an indication to pharmaceutical companies to know how much antivenoms they can actually produce. And this actually knowledge can actually help in reducing the cost of these immunoglobulins or vaccines. The more you produce, or the more companies produce, the less cost that might be, but the higher the cost will be, because actually there will be monopoly and so on. So this is the information that needs to be available. So for global, that will actually help, and will help in the availability and also low costs. But we also need that information at country level to be able to know how we are going to be able to distribute those medical technologies where we need to distribute them appropriately to reduce wastage as much as necessary, and also to ensure that everybody who needs them has access to them. So if we know the burden, we distribute appropriately to the needy areas. Then, of course, we have to make sure that our health system is actually prepared in terms of using them. That is, and also storage. So the capacity of the health workers is to be good. So we have to have adequate trained health workers. We might need to give them additional capacity to manage specific medicines or immunoglobulins, like what we are talking about, so that at least they can give them without causing harm to the patients. And then we also need to have adequate storage conditions, the refrigerators. For most of these immunoglobulins and vaccines, we actually need, most of them require a temperature of 2 to 8 degrees centigrade. And the cold chain needs to be maintained from production to use to the last benefit in the chain. So
how are you maintaining, how do you refrigerate things in the rural parts, in Guruwe, for example? Where is the refrigeration placed, or how do you organize that?
Yes, how do we organize it? There is no electricity in Guruwe, or no no power in Gurube. But we know recently the government and with the support of partners, they've been working on the installation of solar power in many of the rural health facilities. So if I would say, as far as I know now, I think the government has actually done a lot of work in terms of making sure that most of the health facilities, or if not all, except the new ones probably, have capacity to refrigerate, if I would say. So they store their vaccines, they can store their, if we need to give them immunoglobulins, they can actually store them. That's the situation. But I think there is more work that has to be done, of course, in terms of maintenance and also making sure that we respond to breakdowns in a prompt manner, so that at least we don't have any losses due to these issues.
Great job to the Zimbabwean government for managing to install electricity in most of the rural clinics. But is this something that is being done in a lot of African countries? Is that the sort of infrastructure development you are seeing in most African countries in terms of enabling the last mile, those remote places, to have cold chain facilities that allows them to hold antivenom in place and the vaccines that they need to prevent rabies and routine vaccination, of course?
Well, the speed at which this is happening across the continent is actually different. Some countries are moving faster than others, but the good thing is that what we see is most of our governments, they are actually determined to make this happen, but the capacity in terms of the finances may not be there, and some conditions in the country may prevent that from happening, like access through roads and so on. So those are other issues that may actually happen. And I can also say that the work that is being done by local and international philanthropic organization is also an important, is a very big role to play in making this happen. Because like you talk about the issue of vaccination, we can talk about the Gavi, the Bill Gates, the foundation and so on, Bill and Melinda Gates and so on, and many others. I mentioned the ones that are near me. We have been working with countries to ensure that vaccination reaches the furthest. So these have actually been able to assist in making sure that there are fridges at the peripheral, and those fridges are adequately powered to store those vaccines. And that would also allow the storage of immunoglobulins, which require also the similar temperature range to most of the vaccines that we use.
So in Zimbabwe, you are actually routinely buying rabies vaccines and immunizing dogs every year, and buying immunoglobulins. Is this something that is routine, that if somebody gets a snake bite, they can be sure that if they manage to get to a health clinic, they will be able to get an antidote to get to get their animal vaccinated, for instance?
That is an excellent question, but the answer is not as easy as I can put it. So what I can say is the government and the Minister of Health in Zimbabwe is actually trying to make efforts to make sure that the rural communities are reached in terms of access to vaccines, to treatment, or to management of snake bites and rabies. So this is actually work in progress, but I don't think the country is there yet. Still room for a lot of improvement to make sure that this is available. What has been working fairly well is the issue of vaccination of dogs. This is an area which has been led by the government and supported by a number of partners, which WHO is involved, and the OIE, FAO, and many others. So the One Health approach is the one which is anchoring the prevention of rabies through the vaccination of animals, particularly dogs. And there are programs which have been running to ensure that dogs are vaccinated with government leadership and support of various stakeholders. But this is not yet at its, what I can say, at its best to ensure that all dogs are vaccinated. So efforts, I think, should be made to ensure that the country has adequate stocks of vaccines. That's the first thing that we still need to work, the country still needs to work at, to ensure that all dogs that require vaccination are vaccinated, and also to make some stocks available for those of us who do to their occupational to the occupational hazard, they will also need vaccination. So the human and animal vaccines, we still need to work there as a country to make sure that they are available to everyone who needs them.
Obviously, if you're buying for a single country, just for Zimbabwe, the numbers aren't very large. You know, the number of vaccines you would need to vaccinate the dogs, or the amount of immunoglobulin you would need to have on hand in case of bites and antivenom you need instead in case of envenomation. What are the strategies that the government, or you would advise the government to use in order to improve their ability to actually buy those products at a price that is affordable? Are there mechanisms, for instance, at a regional level that allows countries to buy things like anti-venom and rabies vaccine in as a group in order to just improve the demand? I guess you mentioned that if you don't have a lot of people manufacturing these products, it tends to also increase the price. And the answer to that is to generate greater demand, which you can do by bringing more countries to buy together. What is happening across the Africa region in terms of enabling the ability of countries to buy these kinds of products that one generally tends not to buy as part of routine care because it's not something that is at the front of the healthcare system, and yet it's also needed?
There are discussions and negotiations going at the global level. WHO is one of them, trying to work with countries to provide adequate data on the burden of these conditions so that this can actually lead to kind of a forecast of the requirements for each of for countries in terms of responding to these conditions. That's one thing that I can say. So the data is not very much there, and the more data is required. We need to do more work to ensure that we have adequate data to show the true burden of this condition so that we can make estimates, or we can advise those who are with the technological advantage of manufacturing these technologies so that they are available. And then the data, we also can work at a local level, a country making kind of arrangements with the other countries. This is one of the things that is actually promoted in the health in emergencies response. If countries can actually have some kind of understanding with neighboring countries. Like if you look at SADC, for example, in Southern Africa, that can is a potential grouping of countries where they can actually come together and make their order as a consortium and procure these supplies.
Are they doing it?
Not yet now, as far as I know, maybe, but as far as I know, this is not yet happening. And this is something that we would propose to countries to actually make those kind of local arrangements with neighboring countries, taking into consideration their burden and see how they can pull orders. What I can say is we have, the African Union has been working on some pulling of procurements, I think something like that, mostly supported by donors and so on. But it is a good way, which can actually be scaled up at that level, but also sub-regionally to regional levels like the SADC, the EXAS, and so on. And then countries can actually use that advantage of size to procure large quantities, which may actually have the effect of reducing the price of the products that they are procuring.
This is the end of the first part of our conversation on one of the most neglected public health problems in Africa, snake bite and rabies virus infection. Stay tuned for the second part of the conversation coming up next. Join us as we continue our conversation on snake bite and rabies virus infection with Dr. Chimsoro, the WHO National Advisor to the Ministry of Health in Zimbabwe on neglected tropical diseases and malaria. So are there a lot of manufacturers for antivenoms and rabies vaccines in the world globally?
I wouldn't have that offhand, but the technology for manufacturing this is fairly simple. If you look at how people have responded to COVID-19, and almost everyone is having a version of the vaccine. People can do that very much easier for the rabies vaccine, for the rabies immunoglobulin, and for the snake bite antivenom. Those can be done. Companies have the technology. What we don't have currently is we don't have the exact, or we don't have a good estimate of the needs. We also don't have the good estimate of the intention to buy. Because if we may have the needs, but if we don't have the intention to buy, then that will be manufactured and there will be nobody to pick it up and buy it. Those companies also need to make profit. So rather than throwing away. So it is a two-way process where we need to really work together to advise those who have the technology and also to pull out resources to buy those. And then there is a good flow in terms of the supply of this. And then we can manage the prices.
So let's talk about then how at a clinic level, how these problems are being dealt with. So the 2021 to 2030 roadmap for neglected tropical diseases by the WHO, it emphasizes a move from disease-specific provision of care to an integrated approach in order to reduce the burden of these illnesses and to move countries towards elimination or eradication of the 20 listed neglected tropical diseases. Are you seeing this integrated approach happening in Zimbabwe, for example, or anywhere else in the region? In which countries are already implementing an integrated control program and where they have done that, do you see progress in terms of at least improving how these diseases are managed?
Let me talk of a country that I know best, which is Zimbabwe. There has been some movement towards the integration, but also looking at the provision of services at the local level, at the clinics, if I would say. One of the ways that the country has been conceptualizing this is to define a package of services that they would want to be delivered at a local health facility or at a clinic. So by defining, you would actually pick the areas of diagnostics that you want to be available there, and also the area of diseases that those diagnostics should be able to pick, and the treatments that should be available at that local health service. And what we wish is that in this package of services, NTDs should be part of that. Then when the local health facilities decides to procure or request for requirements for the health facility, then they include that as the list of medicines or immunologicals that they want to purchase to support response to the burden of disease in their setting. So this move is taking shape. I see the Minister of Health leading in this, but I think there is it can be actually accelerated, made to move a little bit faster, and we see this happening in every health facility. There is the possibility and an opportunity of this happening. Many of the programs and diseases that we are managing in Zimbabwe, even in Africa, in the world, are also moving into this kind of integration, which actually reduces costs and in terms of how you deliver those services in general.
And you mentioned immunologicals rather, you know, immunoglobulin is an immunological. How much of those type of treatments, the biologics, the immunoglobulins, do you actually use or buy in the health system in Zimbabwe, not just for NTDs, but, you know, just in general for treating cancer and things like that?
The last discussion, of course, that I was part of, I think, I know we were working on a plan, as you talked about, to see the burden of all and the needs of anti-venom. So those are the things. So, and there has been procurement of anti-venom, I remember sometime, this being distributed to certain points. But I would say the distribution then was at secondary level, probably, and at most, but not really going down to the health facilities. So maybe the move in terms of procurement and supply, what the country needs to think about is really making this available at the local health facilities so that the poor rural communities can access them easily and in good time.
What is the big idea of making them available at district and provincial level, which is much further from the people who need them?
Well, the issue here, in my understanding, was to manage stocks and to reduce expiries. But then coming back to your question again is to say, then if you put them there, where probably it's not the epicenter of the happenings of these conditions. How do you make them available at the local health facility? So the issue is, of course, is two ways. One is making a way that a patient who has been affected can move rapidly to that level as and when required. So that means provision of transport. This system has been working in moving referrals like maternal care, other injuries and so on from the health facilities to the next level. And of course, it may be kind of negatively affected by inadequate transport in certain centers. But that same transport which we are talking moving a patient can also be considered to move the health worker with the immunoglobulins to where the patient is. So these are the considerations that can be put in place. But I'm saying this is an intermediate step that the ministry has actually put in place. But in further discussion or conversation at that level, I would really encourage the ministry of health to really think how they can pre-position them at strategic health facilities with higher burden in the rural communities so that those communities can actually access them much easily without having to look for transportation, which we know is not easy to come by in our current state in Zimbabwe.
Indeed, transport is a major challenge for a lot of people trying to access healthcare, and it's one of the major contributions, right? For, you know, maternal deaths, for instance, you know, the challenge of getting pregnant women to a facility where they can get professional help. You mentioned earlier the use of healthcare workers to, you know, to provide and administer these products, these antivenoms and immunoglobulins to rabies, you know, bite victims who might get rabies. Do you have any role, for instance, for traditional healers? Because in a lot of our communities, traditional healers play a very important role in that people go to them with problems. Would the health system be looking to include them as a resource that you could tap into in terms of educating communities, but also making sure that, you know, the right kind of advice and care is provided since they are there talking to people in the communities anyway?
That is a very good question. Traditional healers and other community health workers are very important in the fight against disease in general and in neglected tropical diseases, to be specific. What we desire is that we have everyone at the table, everyone at the deck. There is no big and small person, but everybody has a way of contributing to the burden of disease. So the traditional health, the traditional healers, they are the most trusted community members in many of our African countries, maybe even beyond. But even in Zimbabwe, we know they are very much trusted by our communities. And they are preferably the first a port of entry into the health system. So in our discussion with the health workers, the traditional healers, I know the discussion is already taking place. The ministry is leading that for various ailments, but I would really think that we need to take this up a scale or to continue doing this more vigorously to ensure that traditional health workers, traditional healers, feel they are part of the system. But how do they feel they are part of the system? Is it by administering their traditional medicines? I would say yes for certain conditions and no for certain conditions. So the traditional healers have to know which conditions they have to promptly refer to the next level. And this discussion, I know, has already taken place in conditions like malaria, in the HIV, and other conditions. And the traditional healers are quite aware of how to take care of this and refer them to the next level. And we think this is what they should also take care in terms of looking at snake bites, because there are a lot of remedies that people are using in the communities. Some of them work, some of them they don't really work, and some of them may be dangerous. So we think they should be able to facilitate in making sure that people are aware and they can move rapidly to the next level for care. Talking about snake bites, there are a lot of first aid things that people should also be aware. The issue of immobilization, the issue of wound care if necessary. Of course, that the patient has to be, we respond to their immediate needs, including if they need assisted ventilation and so on. So these things the traditional health workers should be aware of and assist the health system in doing a service to the community.
So the integrated approach would actually involve training community health workers and traditional healers in some of these basics. You know, what do you do if you have this case? This is how you look after the wound. These are the most important things to do immediately. And this is how rapidly you have to make sure that that person gets to a health facility.
Exactly. So we want to use the word training, but I would prefer to use a word like a conversation, a discussion, coming to an agreement to terms of how we do our work and we help each other to deliver the best for the community, which we are all set to actually assist.
I suppose they know how to do their work. Maybe they they would not appreciate being told we're going to train you now. Perhaps sensitization is a better word, you know, sensitizing them adding onto their body of knowledge in terms of how they react in a specific situation. Now, from the context in which you're working, do you see it being feasible to have neglected tropical disease vaccines such as the rabies vaccines and biologics such as the immunoglobulins and antivenoms we're talking about? Could they be perhaps managed using routine immunization program infrastructure, like the expanded program of immunization? And do you see these programs being able to run concurrently, jointly, in order to perhaps minimize some of the hurdles that you have managing the NTD challenges that you have to tackle to get patients the health they need?
You said it very well, and that is a very big opportunity. And that is actually one of the opportunities for integration that we are really talking about. And if you talk about the API infrastructure, we have talked about the cold chain. That is the one that was that one. Of course, there are still gaps that still need to be filled in, but it's fairly good to manage. And we can actually lay on that to move on our NTD area in terms of storage of NTD vaccines, where we have them, where we use them, and also the biologicals like the immunoglobulins, where we need to use them. So that is one. But we can also use those kind of platforms in terms of reaching the communities. And I know at Ministry of Health level, there's also been discussion in terms of integrated outreach services. When we talk of integrated outreach services, we are talking about having everything that a person can actually pick at a health facility available at the outreach point. Where you originally wanted to do immunization or vaccination, you can also take on child health, you can take off maternal health, you can also take delivery of NTD medicines as the mass drug administration where you need. You can actually be able to respond and give education to the communities, give treatments where it is necessary. That is where people really gather when they have different ailments or to take opportunity to respond to the ailments that they have. So this is an opportunity that we can actually take along as we deliver NTDs in an integrated manner in the health system.
What would be the best way to structure the distribution of these products in your view? What would be the most optimal setup? You mentioned the centralized model where you put them in the district and provincial hospitals. And then we talked about how much that is a challenge because it's still very far away from where the victims are who need to have rapid access to these products. Now, from what you've been working in this area, you're seeing the challenges. How would you structure it? Best case scenario, you've got all of the resources that you can have. Now design a distribution structure that is optimal for the patient. What does that look like?
Of course, the distribution system follows the normal Minister of Health distribution system. We have in Zimbabwe, there is a logistics company which is responsible for the government, is the NATFARM, which actually stores at central level and distributes to all health facilities, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, and so on. So how would I want this to happen? We would want this to happen in a way that the needs of each health facilities are met in terms of neglected tropical diseases. So instead of us ending at the district hospital, we should be able to go to the furthest rural health center and give them at least the quantity that they can use to take care of their burden of disease, including NTDs. So how can this happen? This is what I talked about initially when I said we should have a kind of information in terms of the burden of disease at each of and every ward in the country or in each and every catchment area of the rural health center so that we know which rural health centers require how much of these treatments and we give them. And we monitor their usage and we also see how we can actually revise that allocation in due course. This will actually, it may have introduced a little bit of more costs in that we may have a little bit of expense, but it can serve more patients than we are currently able to serve.
That is indeed, you know, something obviously that is needed, how to better serve the needs of the patients. Now, going forward, Dr. Chimsoro, what are the three things that you think countries should do in order to reduce the impact of rabies virus infection and snake bites on the communities that are really the worst affected? What is it that they, you know, the most important things that they can do to minimize the effect and the impact on these communities?
First, I'll mention that all countries need to be aware of the burden of these conditions. So the country burden and the distribution of burden across the country. We know that not every ward, not every district is the same. Some areas are at greater risk than others. So let's know that the distribution. This may be by way of assessments to find out the burden of disease in those different areas, which has to be done initially and has to be done routinely to update our knowledge in terms of this situation. This will actually help us to see how we can make our efforts in terms of distribution of resources and also making awareness, which is my second point, that we have to build to make the community and our health workers aware of these conditions. In certain cases, this may involve a training, and sometimes we may need to support them at their places of work to ensure that they know and understand how to deal with certain conditions. The community, together with the community leadership, have to be engaged, and they have to be clear about the problems or the effects of health issues, and so that they work in together with the health systems to ensure that we improve the health of their population or the people that they work with. We will, of course, need to build capacity where it is required for health workers. We will need to train them in the managing the common conditions, the common entities. We will need to make available these medicines and the diagnostics to the health facilities, the remotest health facility in the rural communities. And so that at least they can distribute, they can make them available to the population as and when needed. Actually, when we do that, this will make the community have much more confidence in the health facility and the desire to have their care taken at the health facility. So these are some of the key issues that I think countries needed really to consider and to put up front as we fight against neglected tropical diseases and make sure that we leave no one behind and in the spirit of universal health coverage.
Dr. Chimzoro, the WHO National Advisor to the Ministry of Health in Zimbabwe on neglected tropical diseases and on malaria. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.